Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Spillers After Show podcast. I am one of your co-hosts, Robert Hickman Jr.
I guess that would make me the other co-host, Brian Dunn. But I'm not really co-hosting this.
You're not really co-hosting this.
And why is that, Robert?
Why is that? It's because we have just finished Spillers number 6, during which we turned the spotlight around on ourselves a little bit.
We did.
In this particular episode of Spillers, a very special episode
of Spillers. Oh, gosh. there we go down that road again.
In this particular episode of Spillers, Mr. Brian Dunn, our Spillers co-host, read his own story. So I'm here to interview him. Welcome to the podcast, Brian.
Hey, thanks for having me.
How you doing?
I'm great. Spillers number 6 was wonderful.
Yeah.
Really enjoyed reading at it.
I'm glad. The audience seemed to really enjoy it as well. It was quite the uproarious reaction.
Oh, wow.
So tell me something.
Okay.
You have a little bit of a history with stand-up comedy, do you not?
I do. That is true. Yeah.
Talk a little bit about that. How do you connect the dots from stand-up comedy to writing humor pieces?
Yeah, well, actually, stand-up comedy is what got me into writing to begin with. I've always been a huge fan of stand-up comedy. I've always been kind of a student of it. And so when I was in college, I decided I wanted to do an open mic night at a local comedy club. This was in Tucson, Arizona, and there was a club called Laughs. And so...
It's a little on the nose.
Yeah. You got to love those club names, right? Chuckles, Laughs. And so they had this open mic night. It was Thursday nights, I think. And you had to prepare, I believe it was 3 minutes of material, which like at the time seemed like so daunting. Like, oh my gosh, how do I fill 3 minutes? When really, you know, it's like no time at all. You get up there, you adjust the mic, and you know, and that's practically it, right?
Yeah. By the time you clear your throat, 3 minutes is gone.
It's gone, and you're off the stage. But I decided, you know, I'm going to write a 3 minute set. I'm going to write 3 minutes worth of jokes, and I did. And I went up on stage and I delivered them, and I got what I considered to be a nice response. People laughed at it, and I thought, oh, this is really cool. So then I decided, you know what, I'm going to go back to the next open mic night. And I did so not realizing that you don't have to write like all brand new material, all new stuff every time. I don't know why I was under the impression that like every set was like brand spanking
new. You wrote
a
brand new set every single time.
I wrote a brand new set.
New 3 minutes every
time. I'm like, you know what, I've mastered this material.
Wow.
Yeah, right? Like
you're making it hard on yourself, man.
Well, I totally did. My naivete was definitely showing. And so I wrote 3 minutes of completely different jokes. Like I think even like in a different style. And I tried them out and went to that next open mic night, did my 3 minutes and did not get the response that I was hoping for. It kind of fell flat. And after, you know, the perceived success of the first time, this was a huge letdown for me.
So you relaxed a little bit. You thought, all right, I've got this.
No, I went the other way and I thought, maybe this isn't for me.
Oh.
Yeah. And so I put it away. I decided, you know what? Gave it a shot. Right? Just 2 open mic nights under my belt, and I'm already throwing in the towel. I'm like, nope, tried
that's
it out.
That's enough to tap out of your new fledgling career.
Yeah, exactly. And so I didn't do anything with it after that until a number of years later. I'd graduated from college, and I was working and doing stuff, and I heard about this stand-up comedy workshop that was taking place in town, and just kind of rekindled the idea of, hey, you know what, let's try writing and performing some stand-up comedy. And so I did, and I had some success doing it, and so I was able to do that for a year around the Tucson and Phoenix areas, and I was paid for it, which I considered to be a huge accomplishment, because
that's a major win.
Yeah, it was a major win.
Supreme validation for...
I thought so as well. And so I really enjoyed doing that, but then I kind of got to a point where, you know, if you wanted to like continue along that path, you had to do like this little mini tour. Mm-hmm. And it was, I think, like Utah, Colorado, and Arizona, maybe New Mexico. There was like this little circuit that you would do. It was all the same comedy club, just different franchises.
There's a brochure. Like, this is the stock comedy tour for your first time out. This is like a thing that everybody did.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, it's kind of what you had to do. And at that time, I was dating, you know, my girlfriend, now my wife, and I had a regular 9-to-5 job. And a lot of the people who I was seeing in the stand-up comedy circles, you know, they didn't really have anything else going on, right? Like, they were couch surfing or living with their parents. Mm-hmm. And so guys like that were able to do stuff like this little, you know, regional circuit. And I just couldn't take four consecutive, you know, weekend. It was so you would be like a Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, you know, that you have to be out of town. And you'd do shows Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And I just couldn't take the time off of work. So, yeah. And which was fine, because when I really sat down and thought about it, I decided that what I liked most about the process was the writing. The performing, I could kind of like take or leave. You know, I mean, it was exciting, but the part that I really took away from it was sitting down at the kitchen table where I used to write all my jokes and creating a joke in my mind and kind of anticipating the audience reaction and, you know, when to pause and, okay, they're going to kind of like, you know, giggle here and then I say this and then they're going to laugh a little bit harder. And it was just constructing the writing that I discovered was the thing for me. And I realized, you know, I can leave the performing part behind, but I can take this writing part and I can do it, you know, whenever and wherever I want. And so that's what I started to do.
Huh.
Yeah.
So you kind of holed up into the back corner of your house and decided, you know, instead of putting myself in front of these people all the time, I can sit here and do it in silence.
I can do it in silence. I can submit it to McSweeney's Internet Tendency.
With no applause.
With no applause. And and I was just fine with that.
And you've appeared in McSweeney's Internet Tendency.
I have appeared. Yeah. And it's funny because the first time I got a piece accepted there, I had just stumbled over, you know, the website. And it just really resonated with me. And I love the style of writing. I love the brand of humor that they were putting out there. And I thought, well, yeah, my stuff should probably be here. You know, seems like a good fit. And so I submitted my first piece and they said, thanks, but no. And I said, okay, no problem. And then I submitted a second piece and they said, yeah, we love it. Absolutely. And I thought, well, this is pretty easy. All right. Which, yeah.
This writer stuff, it's a cakewalk.
I was like, oh my gosh, like second time out, and you know, and I get placed on this website that I love. And what was funny is then I decided, well, you know, I have to have that quick follow up to this, right? Because in my mind I was thinking, well, if you get one piece accepted there, anybody could call it a fluke. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Just in my mind, like I could see people be like, ah, one time, ah, okay, come on, try to do it again.
Yeah.
Right? And so I had this idea in my mind that I had to do that. And so I submitted piece after piece after piece after piece. And they just knocked them all down and said, nope, not going to use any of this.
Wow.
Yeah. And so then,
what do you think the secret sauce was in that first piece?
I don't know. I haven't been able to figure out exactly what those cats are looking for.
Do you just go to sleep at night thinking, God, I wish the editor would just explain to me exactly what I did right that first time? And
well, you know, yeah, I would like that. Absolutely. I mean, who wouldn't like that? yeah, I mean, give me the shortcut here, but I can't crack the algorithm. I have since, though, gotten two more pieces accepted there, and I consider that validation for sure.
For sure.
For my comedy writing.
And in other outlets as well. Like Splitsider.
Splitsider, which is a great comedy website. They have some really funny stuff in there and some great writing about comedy. And yeah, I have a piece there as well.
So tell me about Eel Sauce Blues a little bit. So I know that you have a bit of a jazz background. When I introduced you, I said you're a reformed trumpet.
Trumpet. Yeah, that's... That's true in a lot of ways.
The story is very much about knocking the trumpet player. So
yeah, so Eel Sauce Blues, yeah, it's about the workings of a big band. And so I played jazz all through school, and I was like an all-state jazz trumpet player in high school. And then I went on to play in the U of A big band for a couple years. And the personalities that jazz attracts are just super interesting to
would you count yourself among them?
You know, I always consider myself to be a pretty normal one, and I don't know, maybe people would tell me differently, but you know, one of the characters in the story, the lead trumpet player, is very much modeled on lead trumpet players that I knew and that I had, you know, played in the same section with. And there's something about the egos of those people. You know, there's an old adage that says the two biggest egos in any big band are always the lead trumpet player and the drummer. And so that's what they say.
So I'm a drummer.
Yeah, yeah. I know.
So it's interesting. It's interesting that we would end up pairing up and running a fiction event.
It is, isn't it?
And not starting a band together.
No. I don't think there's a chance of that at this point. I think we're going to stick with the fiction, are we not?
Yeah, I think so.
All right, good.
Wow. So you and I have a shared affinity that I actually picked up from you, in fact.
Really?
A shared affinity for a certain kind of typewriter. I had gone through a couple of them thinking, you know, you want to write the great American novel, you get the great American typewriter. And
yes.
So, you know, you hunt eBay and you hunt Etsy and you find fantastic, you know, the timeless machine, and you set it up, and then you realize that you have to have fingers of steel.
Yes, you do.
And wrists of Herculean
proportions.
In order to actually make the damn thing work. And then one day I show up at a typewriter event, literally a typewriter event.
Yeah, the typewriter roundup, I believe. Is that right?
Typewriter roundup, something like that.
Something like that.
Hosted at Changing Hands Bookstore here in Phoenix, where basically a bunch of people ring in their typewriters and they can all try out each other's typewriters.
That was
basically the gist, but you brought in your little blue IBM Selectric.
Oh, I did.
I hacked away on that thing for a minute, and I was like, oh my. Oh, hello.
Yes. Where have you been all my life?
Oh, hello, IBM Selectric. That thing had the key action of, like, it was better than a laptop because it made the clackety sound, which
did.
Is the all important clackety sound.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But it had the quickness and the lightness of just an incredibly sensitive touch. And after that, I found myself desperately wanting a Selectric of my own.
You really did.
And now I have one.
I know. You're the proud owner of one.
We're Selectric brothers.
We absolutely are.
How did you get turned on to Selectrics in the first place?
Oh, my gosh.
How did you get turned on to typewriters in the first place?
So the way I got turned on to typewriters is it just kind of happened kind of in a flash. I was hanging out with a coworker. And she was telling me about this really great estate sale that she had gone to that weekend. It was kind of something she was doing, going to estate sales and then, you know, getting cool stuff and selling them consignment shops and things like that. And I was standing there, and a fellow writer was also standing there, part of the conversation. And she said, and one of the really cool things I got that I thought you guys would appreciate is I got this really beautiful, wonderful condition, Olympia manual typewriter. And I said, I'll give you $50 for it. Like right then, because like I could just imagine this other writer, you know, trying to scoop this thing up. Mm-hmm. And I'd never had a typewriter prior to that. I just thought it sounded so cool, and the way she described it was great. And she said, okay, deal. And so
it's quite the impulse buy.
It totally was. And it was all because I just didn't want this other person, this other writer, to have it and for like me to miss out on something.
Was he also a trumpet player?
He was not. He is a musician, though.
A little natural competition there.
Maybe a little bit. And so, you know, I took the thing home, and it was amazing. It must have been something that, you know, that the estate owner had like used once in a blue moon, or, you know, had just like forgotten about and left on the shelf, because it was in pristine condition. And I took it to our good friend at Mesa Typewriter Exchange, Bill Wall, and he fixed it up, and it was just fantastic. And I started using it for first drafts of everything I wrote. And then after doing that for a while, I started to think, well, you know, let me see if I can expand my typewriter horizons a little bit. And so at the time, I was doing a lot of reading of Hunter S. Thompson's work, and a lot of reading about Hunter S. Thompson. And, you know, he was a huge IBM Selectric fan. Mm-hmm. And he talks about, you know, like being holed up in a hotel in San Francisco, and he's got this rented IBM Selectric that he's, you know, banging away on, trying to finish whatever he's writing for Rolling Stone at the time. And I thought, yeah, an IBM Selectric, you know, and that had some allure to it. And so I went back to Bill Wall, and I said, looking for an IBM Selectric. He said, well, what do you think of that one on the shelf right there? And it was this beautiful baby blue IBM Selectric that I just fell in love with. And
it's the 11 inch, right?
There's the small 11, 12, 13. The 11 is badass. It's this tiny. I mean, it's as tiny as these things can be. But yeah, I mean, because they're huge, right?
As tiny as a suitcase.
Yeah, exactly. No portability whatsoever. But it's got these beautiful, like, scooped sides and just, oh, just everything about it is just, it's a gorgeous machine and it feels so great to type on that and to write first drafts of all my stuff on it. And it makes this incredible, like, Gatling gun kind of sound, you know, when I get going on it. And I love it. So I love both that one and my Olympia manual. And I wouldn't write first drafts on anything else.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, like, we went to this typewriter event where I discovered Brian's IBM Selectric. Mm-hmm. And we actually met a guy there who claimed to be in possession of the actual typewriter that Hunter S. Thompson used.
Right, when he was in Saigon.
When he was in Saigon, yeah.
Covering the fall of Saigon, right. And Hunter had just, like, pulled up stakes and left, and there was his typewriter.
Right, and this guy, like crossed the room to talk to you because it was straight out of a romance novel, but it was because Brian walked in with a Hunter S. Thompson t-shirt.
Wearing a Hunter S. Thompson shirt, sure.
And this guy just went right to you like a magnet. We ended up talking to him for an hour and a half, and he was really fantastic.
He was great. I think his name is Paul Brinkley Rogers.
Paul Brinkley, yeah.
Yeah.
The Pulitzer Prize
winning. Pulitzer Prize winning Paul Brinkley Rogers, yeah.
So there's that, yeah.
Yeah. Do you remember him inviting us at some point to, like, smoke cigars or something? And then we followed Yeah, I thought that I remembered that.
Like, 2 days later, I was like, he probably just invites everyone that he talks to.
I think that's what it was, because I actually followed up and I was like, hey, you know, Robert and I were ready for that cigar thing. And nothing.
Nothing. Never heard from the guy ever again.
Didn't hear back from the guy, but that's all right.
Figured that probably happens a lot.
It probably does.
So what's next for you with writing? I hear I've known for a long time that you have a novel sitting in a drawer somewhere. What the hell's going on with the novel?
I do. Boy, that's a good question. I mean, this novel thing, it's actually something that I started before the birth of my daughter. And so, to give you an idea, she turns 10 in January.
Well.
Yeah.
So it's coming right along.
So it's been in, you know, what, fits and starts and bursts of creativity. But yeah, it's finished, and it's been finished for a while, and I've been dreading the editing process, but I've jumped into it, and I've got about a quarter of it edited right now, and I'm going to continue with that and get it done and finished and in the best shape that I can, and whatever comes of it comes of it, and then I'm going to move on to the next one.
Nice.
Yeah. It's just something that I have to finish. I have to kind of stick a fork in it and say, yes, this was my best attempt.
Yeah.
And here it is.
Yeah. At some point, you have to reach out and go, okay, is this the best this is ever going to be?
Right. Because there are other... Yeah, absolutely. There are other stories to tell and other novels to write. And obviously, I've been doing other writing over the course of this this novel saga with the humor writing and the short stories. But I'm going to knock this one out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could sleep at night knowing that something was, like, imperfect. Like, I need to go back to it and tweak it even more and more and more. I feel like years could go by.
Sure.
But I'm going to ask you this question. We talked a little bit with Jenny Irish about this, but I wanted to bring it up here again. So you wrote the intro to this chapbook for Spillage number 6. And it was a little reflective about the need for art at a time when the universe is fairly divided and what can art do there, and at what point is it an artist's responsibility to kind of step up and take that on. How do you pit that against your humor writing? Like, where does humor fit into that first? And second, where do you see yourself going having had that epiphany?
Yeah, well, that's... Yeah, boy, there's a lot to that for sure.
Feel free to just get up and leave now.
Well, it's interesting because the foreword for the chapbook for Spiller 6, it was really inspired by just some conversations that I saw creatives having over social media, a conversation that you and I had at a Changing Hands bookstore, and just a general feeling that I was having where I was wondering, am I making the best use of my writing? Is there something more I should be doing with it? Because I love humor, for sure. I mean, humor is very important to me. I think humor helps us get through incredibly difficult times. And it's very important. But then, you know, I looked at, like, for example, the short story that I read tonight. I picked that, you know, I wrote that for this, but I had some others that I had been working on that were in various stages that I felt I could complete for it. And a couple of them started to look kind of frivolous to me a little bit. And so I did have to take some time and kind of reflect about it and decide, well, you know, do I want to go in a different direction possibly with my writing? What's my responsibility as a writer? And I kind of, you know, talk about that in the foreword to the book. And I went into sort of a kind of a mini funk recently. But then in the end, I realized that there's a lot of power in humor. I love humor. And as I write in the foreword, the role of art is to exist. And just through its ability to exist and for us to partake in it, it can heal us. And it doesn't have to do anything more than just be what it is. And if it's a funny short story and it makes you laugh and just be in a better mood, then that's as completely valid as something that maybe stirs some deeper or, you know, altruistic emotions or convinces you to, you know, take some positive social action. You know, in my mind, it's all worthwhile, and they're, you know, worthy endeavors, all of them. And that's what I came around to deciding, and I'm glad I read the story that I read, and I think we need humor. It's super important, and that's what I'm going to continue to do. Whatever I write, I like for there to be a humorous element, and so I'm going to keep doing that.
Right on. Yeah. Well, it looks like it went over well with the audience.
Yeah. They were great. The audience was great tonight.
Yeah, our audience is always fantastic.
I know. How do we get these people? You always remark, who are these people who come out?
Who are these people?
Well, they are great people, whoever they are.
They are great people. So yeah, now that you've had this experience, I'm a little nervous about doing it myself in Spiller 7. It was really easy at that first event.
Because, yeah, it really was, wasn't it?
But our bar has raised so much since then. We've had some just absolutely incredible writers.
Oh yeah,
in the past few events, and yeah, I'm nervous to stand amongst them.
Well, you'll do a great job, and looking forward to seeing what you come up with for that. That's going to be great.
So thank you for bringing your story tonight. Thank you for being a guest on the podcast.
Oh yeah,
hosting it for once.
This was really fun to be a guest.
Yeah,
I like this.
It's going to be really strange sitting on the other side of this table, in the strange Crescent Ballroom green room. Yeah. So until next time, people.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.